All right, I'm going to continue my series on the sixth commandment. The sixth commandment is thou shall not kill or thou shall not murder. I was talking to a friend just yesterday and I told him that this was going to be my fifth sermon on the topic of thou shall not murder. And he asked, he said, is that a problem in your congregation? No, but it is definitely a problem in our culture. And so far we've looked at homicide and suicide and euthanasia and abortion. And today I want to look, I will be touching on the topic of abortion, but it'll be on the topic of infanticide, the emphasis. And that's killing the child once it's been born. Now, what I want to do this morning is take you through a bit of a history tour. I want us to consider how historically the sixth commandment was applied, especially as it refers to abortion and infanticide, because these are very ancient practices. And so the Jewish people, when they read that command and they looked at what was happening in their culture, they had to make some decisions about how that command applies. And I want to look also at how Christians applied this command throughout their history. Were these acts considered murder? That's a very sobering question. So this morning what I want to do is look at and I have a number of quotes so that you can hear from these individuals who lived at that particular time. You'll hear from some historians as well on all sides of this issue. But first, I mentioned, I believe it was last week, that the act of intentional abortion is not mentioned in the Bible. But there is a consistent attitude towards life in the womb, and just one of many verses, Genesis 16:11. The angel of the Lord said to Hagar, you are now with child, and you will have a son, and you shall name him Ishmael. And so you notice that the assumption is that there's this continuity. You are with child, and this child will be a son, and this son you will give him the name that I gave you. So there's just the continuity of life, continuity of personhood, starting from inside the womb to outside the womb. Another passage is Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 4 and 5. The word of the Lord came to me, saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart, and I appointed you as a prophet to the nation. And so God says, not only did I know you in the womb, I knew you before you were even in the womb. You're a product of my thoughts. But he does say, I formed you in the womb. I'm the author of your life. I knew you. I had a plan for you. I loved you. So biblically, theologically, there's always this foundation in Scripture that gives us a basis to regard life and personhood as sacred from the womb onwards. And of course, the most important statement is found in the early chapters of Genesis, where we are told that human life is made in the image of God. There's this intrinsic value to human life. Humans are unique amongst all the creatures and species that God made, known and loved by God. Was Israel the only nation in ancient times that valued life in the womb and of children once they were born? It appears that Persia valued life as well from the womb onwards. But these are exceptions. What we find in so much of human history is a devaluation of the early stages of life. I think the first example of infanticide in the Bible is when Pharaoh commands the midwives to kill the children. If it's a boy, kill him, and if it's a girl, let her live. In some ways, it's not the parents doing it, so it's the state, and in that sense, it's perhaps more homicide, but they practiced infanticide for purposes of population control, very similar to what we saw in China. And of course, if you do away with all the boys, eventually you end up with a genocide of a nation, right? But the midwives, they were the first ones to oppose infanticide, and then we see that God used an Egyptian princess to save Moses from infanticide. What a beautiful picture that is. You know, she's taking this child and she has no idea of the potential and God's purpose for this human being. He has no idea what's in that child. In scripture as well, one of the cruelest forms of death was associated with a god called Molech. He was the god of the Canaanites. Pictures of him, he has this head of a bull and the body of a man, made of statue out of him, is made out of brass, and his hands were stretched out, ready to receive your sacrifices. And this statue, there was fire built on the bottom, and it became visible as well, and priests would take children, and they would lay these children on the arms of Molech, and the child would be essentially burnt alive. And historians have said, pointed out that, of course, the child, you know, would initially cry out, and so what they did as part of the ritual is they had people beating drums very loud so that the parents could not hear the cries of the children. And interestingly, throughout the Old Testament, there are numerous warnings against this barbaric practice of child sacrifice. And sad to say, but Israel felt prey as well to this God. If you look at Psalm 106, verse 37 to 39, the psalmist says, they worshipped, speaking of Israel, they worshipped their idols, which became a snare to them. And they sacrificed their sons and daughters to demons. And they shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. And the land was desecrated by their blood. And in Leviticus 18:21, there's commands, do not give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech, for you must not profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. Chapter 20, verses 1 to 5, the Lord said to Moses, say to the Israelites, any Israelite or any alien living in Israel who gives any of his children to Molech must be put to death. In the eyes of God, this was worthy of capital punishment. Instead, the Lord would say, give me your children, dedicate your firstborn son, don't kill or murder them. This is the practice associated with false gods and idols. You shall not be like them. There's an Old Testament scholar, Richard Davidson, speaking about Mesopotamia, where that's where Iraq and Kuwait are today. And he mentions another phrase called exposing children, which was very common throughout world history. And this is this is a quote. The practice of parents exposing their children, mostly girls, seems to have been quite widespread throughout the ancient Mesopotamia during the entire period of biblical history. So what that means is that when it says that children were exposed, people would take a child, perhaps put them in a basket or something, and then go to a dark alley, leave it there, or they would go to the woods, leave the child there, or the mountains or rivers or wells, even swamps or puddles, he said. And most of these children were exposed immediately after birth with their blood still on them. They would take these children and just drop them wherever. This was common, commonly done. What about the ancient Greeks? Who are the two most well-known philosophers in ancient Greece? Plato and Aristotle. These were the wise men. What did they think about abortion, and what did they think about infanticide? For Plato, both abortion and infanticide were acceptable, because the goal really was the quality of the citizens, all right? You had to be healthy, you had to look good, you had to be beautiful. And he says, the offspring of the inferior and any of those of the other sort who are born defective, they will properly be disposed of in secret so that no one will know what has become of them. Okay, we don't want people necessarily to see this. Not everybody can stomach it. So we're going to do it behind the scenes. No cameras available. And here's Aristotle. As to exposing or rearing the children born, let there be a law that no deformed child shall be reared. If there's any child with any deformity, there should be a law. It should not be up to the parents whether they want to keep the child or not. Nazi ideology and how they treated the weak and the deformed and all the rest didn't begin with Germany. It had all these ancient supporters as well. Were there any voices that were opposed? It does seem that the Pythagoreans, a group in ancient Greece, did oppose it. And Hippocrates, you've probably all heard about the Hippocratic Oath. He lived from 460 to 370 BC, known as the father of medicine. And he said this, remarkable. I will follow that method of treatment which, according to my ability and judgment, remember, he's a doctor, and he encourages other doctors to do the same. I consider for the benefit of my patients, and I will abstain from whatever causes harm and is mischievous. I will give no deadly drug to anyone if asked, nor suggest any such counsel. So there you go, no euthanasia. And in like manner, I will not give a woman a pessary to procure an abortion. I will not do it. So already in ancient Greece, that seems that there were some voices that were opposed. Another Greek historian by the name of Plutarch, getting closer to the first century now, or actually he did live in 46 to 119 AD. This is how he describes how birth would take place in Sparta, which was a Greek city-state. He said, a father is obliged to carry the newborn child before the elders of the tribe, and their business, elders, is to carefully view the infant, and if they find it stout and well-made, they give order for its rearing and allotted to it one of the 9,000 shares of land above mentioned for its maintenance. But if they find it puny and ill-shaped, they order it to be taken to a large cave in the Peloponnese, and they think it neither for the good of the child nor for the public interest that it should be brought up, if it did not from the very outset appear to be healthy and vigorous. So these elders would make the decision. It wasn't, again, not the decision of parents. It would be the decision of the state, because a child belonged to the state as well. And if they deemed that it wasn't healthy, or then it was to be killed or given up. So that's Greece. What about Rome? Well, here's Cicero. He lived from 106 to 43 AD. In a book called On the Laws, he says, deformed infants shall be killed, period. Seneca, lived in the time of Christ, 4 BC to 65 AD. He says, "Mad dogs we knock on the head, the fierce and savage ox we slay, unnatural offspring we destroy. We drown even children who at birth are weakly and abnormal. But it's not out of anger, but reason that separates the harmful from the sound." And in the Roman Republic, it says that the earliest Roman law code permitted a father to expose any female infant he wished and a deformed baby of either sex. So infanticide really was just the normal method of birth control for Greeks and for Romans, because taking poison, contraception, anything like that, that was dangerous. Abortions were very dangerous as well. So instead, what they decided they would do is that they would let the child come to, be born, and then they would look at the child and they would make a decision. But if there were deformed, weak, illegitimate, unwanted infants, such as girls, they would be done away with. In fact, here's a private letter sent in the first century from a husband to a wife. "If it's a male, let it be. If a female, expose it." The total opposite of Pharaoh's instructions. So the Roman historian Tacitus, again, lives AD 56 to 120, so it's in the time of Paul, and this is what he would write about these, the strange and exotic practices of foreigners. He was used to looking around at how the different people, all these different traditions and everything. You know what he found really strange about the Jews? This is what he writes, and he writes it with a sense of astonishment. "Infant exposure is unknown amongst the Jews. In fact, they regard it as a crime to kill any recently born child." Like, they are like, "What? Have you heard of such madness? Jews don't do that to their children. They keep their deformed kids. They keep their girls. They don't, like..." For him, this was like totally foreign. Actually, I did come across two very well-known Jewish scholars. One is Philo, who lived 20 BC to 50 AD, again, during the time of Christ and the time of the apostles. And he was expounding this commandment, the sixth commandment, that you shall not kill. And he touches on the issue of infanticide. And he says, this is what's going on. "Some of them," meaning probably the parents, but it could be the elders, "some of them do the deed with their own hands. With monstrous cruelty and barbarity, they stifle and throttle the first breath which the infants draw, or they throw them into a river, or into depths of the sea, after attaching some heavy substance to make them sink more quickly under its weight. Others take them to be exposed in some desert place." Okay, so exposed means that they're still probably alive. "But they take them to some desert place, hoping they themselves say that they may be saved, but leaving them in actual truth to suffer the most distressing fate, for all the beasts that feed on human flesh visit the spot and feast unhindered on the infants, a fine banquet." And Josephus, who lived 37 to 100, again, during the period of the disciples, he contrasted the Jewish culture from the Greco-Roman culture, and he says, "The Mosaic law forbids women to cause abortion of what is begotten or to kill it afterward. And if any woman appears to have done so, she will be a murderer of her child by killing a living creature and diminishing humankind." Strong words from Josephus. All right, let me come to Christianity. What about Christians? As I was just putting this together, the earliest records of Christians, going back to the early church fathers, let's say from the first century right up until the fourth, they all spoke very strongly against abortion and against infanticide. And they would speak this out from their pulpits to the people, and they would write about this in their works, and they would challenge the people of their culture to consider what they had to say. But let me be clear that when they took that stand, there was no support for this point of view in the culture. They were out of step with pagan culture. I'll just read you a few. The Didache was probably written somewhere between 50 to 70 AD. So contains the statement, "You shall not procure an abortion nor destroy a newborn child." Again, this is one of the earliest documents that we have. The letter of Barnabas in 74 AD, "You shall not slay the child by procuring an abortion, nor shall you destroy it after it's born." Athenagoras, 177 AD, says, "Women who induce abortions are murderers and will have to give an account of it to God." Tertullian, 197 AD, "We may not destroy even the fetus in the womb, nor take away a life that was born." And then Jerome actually gives us an insight to some of the things that was going on. He says, "Some go as far as to take potions that they may ensure barrenness, and thus murder human beings almost before their conception. And some, when they find themselves with child through their sin, they use drugs to procure an abortion, and when, as often happens, they die with their offspring, they enter the lower world laden with the guilt not only of adultery against Christ, but also of suicide and child murder." Apostolic Constitutions, 400 AD, "You shall not slay thy child by causing abortion, nor kill that which is begotten." Again, I want you to just notice, it was always abortion, infanticide, inside the womb, and then when it comes outside of the womb. Another early church father, Methedes, contrasted the Christian life with pagans. He said, "We marry like everybody else, but we don't destroy our children. We are different. We live differently." And then Justin Martyr as well, who lived 100 to 165. "As for us, as Christians, we are taught that even to expose newly born children is a wicked act. We're taught this because we must do no one an injury, and also because we must not sin against God, for we see that almost all so exposed, and not only the girls, but also the boys," which suggests that the boys were fewer than the girls. "But what happens when they get exposed and they get left around," he says, "they're brought up to prostitution. People do go get them. And as the ancients are said to have reared herds of oxen or goats or sheep or grazing horses, so now we see you rear children for this shameful use. A multitude of women and unmentionable perverts exist for this vile purpose in every nation." That's what they did. So whenever some people, they say, "Oh, there's a child here, let's take it in. We can use it at the brothel. Let's take this one in. We can use him as a slave," and so on and so forth. That's how human life was treated. So what did the Christians do about it? Yeah, they definitely spoke. They spoke out in their preaching, and they spoke out in their teaching and in their writings. But they also felt that they had a duty, that when they saw a child, they couldn't just leave it there. Here's what Tertullian says about Christians. He said, "Christians sought out the tiny bodies of newborn babies from the refuse and dung heaps and raised them as their own, or tended to them before they died, or gave them a decent burial." And Christians frequently adopted children that were unwanted by the parents into their families. One author also mentions that historically what ended up happening was that as the local population began to, you know, pay attention to these Christians with their crazy ideas about life, what ended up happening is that many mothers began to leave their unwanted babies at the doors of churches in the hope that they would be cared for. Because again, mothers weren't the ones who made the decisions. And so they would take their child, and they wanted the child to live, and so they would put it at the doorstep of churches. And as the numbers grew, then Christian orphanages were set up in the 3rd and 4th centuries. And then Christian hospitals began to be established towards the end of the 4th century. And many of the hospitals had a section specifically set apart for abandoned children. You know that? Not specifically set apart for abortion clinics, specifically set apart for abandoned children. Why did they care? Why do this? I mean, these were not their children. Again, they got their ideas about the value of life from Christ and from Scripture, and they had leaders that would not keep quiet about this issue. They spoke regularly on them, challenging the church not to turn away, not to become neutral on a topic of this nature. And they knew that if they were going to be disciples of Jesus, that meant that they would have to love their neighbor and take care of the weak and the vulnerable. I remember going to Ottawa, and there was a pro-life gathering there, and Melanie Green was there. I don't know how many of you know who Melanie Green, Keith Green's wife, and also Mother Teresa. And I remember Mother Teresa saying to the crowd, "If you don't want your children, give them to me. I want them. Christ wants them." It's the voice of the Lord. What about the Catholic Church? The Catholic Church, pretty much throughout its whole history, has been in favor of protecting life. The Second Vatican Council called abortion and infanticide unspeakable crimes. Pope John Paul II stated, "I declare that direct abortion that is willed as an end or as a means always constitutes a grave moral disorder, since it's the deliberate killing of an innocent human being." He says, "No circumstance, no purpose, no law whatsoever can ever make licit an act which is intrinsically illicit, since it is contrary to the law of God, written in every human heart, knowable by reason itself, and proclaimed by the church." Now, it did permit, if a mother's life was in danger, it would permit abortion in those circumstances. I have to say, I've often been critical about the Catholic Church and many of their views and doctrines, but on this issue of abortion and infanticide and their understanding of ethics generally, I deeply appreciate the work of Catholic scholars. I think some of the best work is done by Catholics. And I believe that we as evangelicals should consider working closely with Catholics on this task of saving life. I want to go to the 20th century, but first, what about the Reformation? How did the Reformers deal with this? I'm just going to quote one person, John Calvin, where he says, "For the fetus, though enclosed in the womb of its mother, is already a human being. And it's almost a monstrous crime to rob it of the life which it has not yet begun to enjoy. If it seems more horrible to kill a man in his own house than in a field, because a man's house is his place of most secure refuge, it ought surely to be deemed more atrocious to destroy a fetus in the womb before it has come to light. It's God made the womb to be a safe place. Just looking as well in terms of missionaries throughout the latter part from 15 to the 20th century. Missionaries like William Carey, he lived in 1761 to 1834. When you read his writings, he talks about he was a missionary to India, and what he saw there just concerned him greatly. And much of the killing of infanticide and other forms of murder were done in the name of religion. So he appealed to the British government in India and trying to save life, and they didn't want to get involved because they said, we don't get involved in religious matters. But then in a letter to John Ryland, 6 years later, he said, I have, since I've been here, presented three petitions or representations to government for the purpose of having the burning of women and other modes of murder abolished, and in the case of infanticide and voluntary drowning in the river, that laws were made to prevent these, which have been successful. So he made a difference, That was another way of trying to work with the government to pass just laws to save life. Another one is Mary Slessor, 1848-1915. She was a missionary from Scotland and went to Nigeria. And in Nigeria, there was this practice that if twins were born, they eventually ended up getting killed because somehow they were believed that this was an evil omen and that these kids were going to grow up possibly to kill their parents. And so she made a big difference in Nigeria. Unfortunately, I think some of this is still going on, and there are missionaries still hard at work to try to save the lives of twins. All right, 20th century. I'm just going to quote this one believer, Bonhoeffer. As you know, Bonhoeffer ended up being hung by the Nazis because of his desire to contribute to the end of the destruction of the Jews. But this is what he says about, he said, destruction of the embryo in the mother's womb is a violation of the right to live, which God has bestowed upon this nascent life. To raise the question whether we are here concerned already with a human being or not is merely to confuse the issue. The simple fact is that God certainly intended to create a human being, and that this nascent human being has been deliberately deprived of his life. And then he says, and this is nothing but murder. Now he goes on as a pastor to talk about the many different problems and issues that people may be facing in their life and the despair that they may be experiencing and the difficult circumstances that women may find themselves in, economic problems and misery. And what he says is that, if these are the motives that sometimes people have, I hold the community responsible as well. That the Christian community, if you know that people are going through all these problems, then step in, help them out. Don't just tell them it's wrong, get involved. But then he ends this by saying, but although there are many different influences and reasons why people might end up doing an abortion, it does not in any way alter the fact of murder. So he was still very clear on that. Have compassion, but at the same time, don't give up your principles. Don't give up the conviction that's based on the Word of God. I am grateful that infanticide is illegal in Canada and in the States. for the most part. I think there are voices that are beginning to be heard in favor of it. There are policies beginning to push this. And in the name of science, in the name of compassion, in the name of progress, in the name of the ideal society, we are beginning to see people trying to change these laws. And again, to give you just a few examples, James Watson, he was the co-discovery of the DNA double helix, 1928 to 1968. Okay, he's a scientist. He advocated waiting 3 days after a baby is born before deciding whether it should be allowed to live. The rationale is that some genetic defects are not detectable until after birth. So 3 days, we give people a 3-day period. His partner, Francis Crick, 1916 to 2004, agreed, no newborn infant should be declared human until it has passed certain tests regarding its genetic endowment. And if it fails these tests, it forfeits the right to life. Joseph Fletcher, 1905 to 1991, genetically defective fetuses and newborns do not attain the status of personhood. They are subpersonal organisms and therefore fail to qualify for the right to life. One more, Peter Singer, he's still alive today, very influential in medical ethics, born 1946. This is what he says. At present, parents can choose to keep or destroy their disabled offspring only if the disability happens to be detected during pregnancy. So if they kill it in the womb. But there's no logical basis for restricting parents' choice to these particular disabilities. If disabled newborn infants were not regarded as having a right to life until, say, a week or a month after birth, it would allow parents, in consultation with their doctors, to choose on the basis of far greater knowledge of the infant's condition than is possible before birth. So for him, he's willing to wait a month, according to this particular quote. Some have him now going much, much further than a month. This gives you an idea of how people are pushing. If it's okay to abort, then why not kill as soon as they're born? What's the logic there? Let me conclude here. I'm doing this primarily so that you can see that there is a long line, tradition of respecting human life amongst Christians. That fact goes all the way back to Genesis, and it's been the understanding of God's people throughout all generations. And I need to say this, but the pro-life position is not some recent political position of white men, right-wing conservatives. I wanted you to hear how far back it goes. We're just being ignorant of the longstanding historical practice of the Christian church and its call to protect human life. They were saving human beings long before they had any political power or any political influence. For them, it was about human life and human beings. That's what the issue was about. I don't know how many of you caught this, but the ancient writers that I've quoted mention the killing of especially girls. Infanticide and exposing was especially deadly to girls. One thing that is very clear is that nobody ever accused the early Christian church of being anti-woman. If anything, everybody would say they are pro-women. They're saving girls. Most cultures were getting rid of them, and they were saving them. And then they saved them from prostitution as well, because they valued their life. They saw that boys or girls had intrinsic value. There's a very powerful story of a pastor in South Korea. And he started a ministry called the Baby Box. And actually, I'm going to let him tell the story. So if we could just turn the lights off. Somebody turn the lights off there. And I want you to, we'll watch this video. Just so that you know as well that there is some criticism of what he's doing. But it's, yeah, if you're going to do God's work, you got to be open to criticism. So here it is. The pastor and his wife, in my views, but they are heroes. There's a verse that is inscribed in the box, and the verse is Psalm 27:10. Although my father and mother forsake me, the Lord will take me in. I conclude with these words. Let the little children come to me, said Jesus, and don't hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. Amen.